One of the most astounding publishing stories of the early 1980s was the runaway success of the bestseller Megatrends. Its author, John Nesbitt, identified 10 major trends representing sweeping changes within Western society. The movement from an industrial society to an information society. The movement from national economies to a world economy. The move from highly centralized hierarchies and bureaucracies to decentralized and participative workforces, and so on. While no one would ignore the larger evolutionary changes that are going on, most of us are more concerned with the micro trends and micro changes that impact our everyday world and which tend to create friction and irritation or inconvenience within our purview. Remember that great restaurant you used to go to? Then it changed management and the quality of the food went downhill. Some of you men may be experiencing for the first time the opportunity of working for a female boss. And some of you may have recently had a problem in the family because your values are being challenged in terms of role changes there. The type of changes that affect and influence most of us are not the large sweeping changes, but the continuing stream of smaller changes that must be accommodated within our own system. A lot of people are getting fed up with the amount of changes occurring. A lot of people have become dissatisfied with and alienated by a world that seems to be becoming increasingly more plastic, phony, and artificial. A lot of people are becoming fed up in dealing with a world where the rate of change is so high that nobody is able to keep up with it, where the benefits we receive from all these new and wonderful innovations come at too high a cost in terms of our personal price. It's been said that the only constant is change. Whether you're the initiator of change or the recipient of change, and whether that change is occurring within your personal life or work world, it is important to understand that resistance to change is normal. It is not that people are obstinate in resisting change. It is not that they are against good change. It is not that there are no logical reasons for change. But people are wired to resist change unless change occurs under certain conditions. As we think about changes that we want to make in our relationships with others in the work that we do or at home, or if we're contending with changes being caused by others, an examination of the reasons why we ourselves resist change may be useful. To put this into perspective, think of a time when you personally resisted change. Someone in your life or circumstances forced this change upon you, or your daily living required changes from you. You resisted, perhaps even fought the change, or you suffered some emotional trauma and pain because of the change. Consider the specific conditions of that situation you encountered, and then let's see if you can identify your own resistance in the list of common reasons why people resist change. First, we need to understand that our feelings of confidence in any situation result from our feelings of competence. William James wrote, "Action seems to follow feeling, but in truth, feeling follows action." We can never feel positive about any behavior in our life until we have first established competence over that behavior. A new trainee in a job is going to be scared to death until he has achieved some form of mastery of the task, and having achieved that mastery, will have a sense of confidence within that work. A teenager who is just beginning to date feels awkward and confused in his or her relations with the opposite sex, and not until the social skills of dating are acquired will that teenager feel a sense of confidence and security. In short, we feel adequate only in the familiar. When change is introduced into an otherwise familiar and stable situation, it will not be seen as easily grasped, but as complex and ambiguous. Change threatens the sense of the familiar. Change shakes our confidence. Of course, we're not less competent as human beings, but we are incompetent, or more properly worded, we have not yet gained competence in the new task or situation. Consequently, we feel a lack of confidence and the presence, sometimes, of real fear. Since change puts us into a situation in which we do not have competence, that often generates a feeling that areas in which we are presently competent are also being criticized. We tend, in other words, to generalize our fears. We tend to enlarge the change area to assume that other more familiar areas have also come under attack. We feel and interpret the change as criticism of other areas of our life, as a criticism of our personal image and our self-esteem, and so we think we are being criticized. We think we are being attacked. And when we think we are being attacked, we perceive threat in the situation. And when threat is perceived in the situation, we will find the survival mechanisms that I refer to as the F reactions taking place. Not only flight or fight, but fear and self-flagellation and faking and forgetting. Change inevitably leads to the sense that those who are changing the circumstances around us must not love us anymore, must not care for us. In fact, that changes may be part of a general policy requirement forced on the organization by changes in the law. These organization-wide changes are always personalized. We take it as a personal attack. It's as though our executives have singled us out. In our own homes, a teenager challenges the dating rules that have been previously established. As parents, we go into paroxysms of self-criticism. Where have I failed? In such a situation, whether it makes sense to us or not, is it any reason to resist change? We will seek to protect ourselves through all kinds of devious means. We have to understand that both in our own reactions and in the reactions of others around us, that such fighting and defensive reaction are normal human responses. Another reason why change is resisted is that if you want me to change a way in which I'm doing my job or the way in which I'm relating to you as an individual, then that is also negating or forgetting the fact that the way in which things are presently constructed often represents my own contribution, my creativity. I may have partially created the relationship as it now exists. To change that relationship is to challenge my creativity, as if to say that my thinking and the product of my creativity are not adequate. I am self-invested, you see. I am identifying myself in this whole construct of relationships which may now be changed. The current way of doing things, the status quo, is in part my baby. And if you seek to change that, I feel that you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and that baby is, in a sense, me. At least it's a part of me. This leads to a feeling that I'm just a cog in the wheel. Charlie Chaplin was noted in some of his comedies for his attack on the incursion of production line techniques, which at that time were new in American manufacturing. You may have seen some of the famous scenes where Charlie has a wrench that is almost as large as he is, and he's getting caught in the machinery and the gears, a feeling that he is being ground up in this new mechanistic world. Prior to the assembly line, most work in the United States was handwork. It was literally made by hand. It was tailored. It was individually put together. And to move from that kind of work to the kind of work where man was nothing but an extension of the machine was to suffer an immense loss of personal control. It was to be made a part of the machine, to be yet another gear. There are so many instances around us of people who have dropped out of successful careers and who have gone on to start small businesses, or who may stay on their job and yet spend unbelievable amounts of money on various hobbies. The crafts industry, for example, is a multi-billion dollar industry based on people's needs to find creativity and self-expression and to be able to show by the work of their hands a mirror image of the excellence that they perceive within their own talent and genius. My work is not just my work. It is me. When you change my relationships with others, or change the work, or change the way in which things have been done, it makes me feel as though I am trapped, that I am a victim, that I am forced to do things your way, and consequently I am going to feel less important. I am going to lose a feeling that before I was needed and now I no longer am needed, or that you don't need things from me in a way that you used to. It is to break down the emotional ties which give me a sense of belonging to others in my family or my work group. Often the messages that come from one marriage mate to another or from a boss to a subordinate are that you should comply, that you must conform, and that somehow this other person is expecting you to live up to their expectations, to see things the way they see things. Is it any wonder that people in a sense of defensiveness will seek to contest that decision? One of the things that people do to resist change very successfully is to cause delays. Often in work groups, we'll see subordinates placing the new required change at the bottom of things to do. Often we will see across the coffee cups in the employee cafeteria members of the group seeking to protect themselves from vacillating, ever-changing management. Often unions will use words to describe their role as protecting workers from management and management's changes. In fact, the work group, the family group, is often evaluating change in terms of whether it is a good deal or a bad deal for the group and for individuals within the group. And each individual is evaluating the change in terms of the payoffs and the costs to themselves. If that cost-benefit ratio is out of whack, employees, people, will reject change. Change is resisted then for both good and bad reasons. If we can understand that change will be resisted, then we will, if we're in management, make sure that whatever changes we ask are truly worthwhile and needed, and seek to find ways around the humanity in people that causes them to resist change, and move positively to help people find ways to adjust to these changes, to understand and comprehend them. If we ourselves are experiencing a great deal of change, it may help us to understand that at heart, we are not the problem. That our self-esteem does not depend on any job or the way in which the job is performed. If in our own personal relationships we can see that change is sometimes beneficial, then we might turn from a defensive and reactive position to an offensive and a proactive position in terms of controlling change in a positive way. As we consider how to control change and continue to manage the normal circumstances which we can expect within our families or within a job setting, it's important to keep in mind that the prime factors we have to deal with are the perceptions, feelings, and emotions of people. It is not a time to operate with more facts alone, or to reason like a courtroom lawyer, or to use some kind of superior logic or hard sell, or try to force or coerce people. We have to deal with the emotional component, the emotional reaction. Change resistance is primarily that, resistance to change, rather than a rejection of your reasons for making the change. A second key awareness is that this is the time for leadership of the other people involved in the equation. We know from leadership studies that leadership requires an orientation for getting things done, in this case, actually implementing a change. It also requires a personal connection. In a time of change, it is important to focus more on the people and their reactions, their feelings, their need for consideration, rather than to focus on the change itself. That is, if you want effective change management, be less concerned with the specific details of the technical change and more concerned with the people. One of the ways in which you can show leadership is to explain to people why the change is occurring, that is, the history behind the problem and the rationale behind the change. Explain why, and then listen. The fact that you have offered an explanation is a signal to the other parties that you're willing to cross the bridge to them, that you're willing to have a conversation with them. And the fact that you're willing to listen and to ask questions sends a second equally important signal, and that is, I want this to be a dialogue. Sometimes you'll find that people will resist certain elements of the change, but not the entire change. Some managers, some husbands, some mothers immediately react to the fact that not all aspects of a necessary change have been immediately accepted. But a proper leadership technique would be reinforcement for the acceptance of whatever portion of the change is accepted. Let's say an employee says to you, I can see why this needs to be done. I just don't understand why we have to do it this way. Instead of criticizing them for not buying into your proposed approach to the change, say something like this, Gee, I really appreciate the fact that you can sense in this situation, as I do, the need for change. And I'm certainly open to hearing other ideas you might have as to different approaches we might take to it. Reinforcing their partial acceptance is a signal that acknowledges an ability and an openness to make additional step-by-step acceptance in the future. Some people in authority sometimes believe that their role is to be the enunciator and articulator of change, the person who dictates the change. And as a dictator, they have a hard time saying to another human being, I need your help. But in studies of managers' subordinates, employees report almost unanimously that supervisors who ask for help, who ask for assistance, who express appreciation for partial compliance with the change in its early stages, and who signal their interdependency with the others, are seen by subordinates as strong leaders. Indeed, it is a sign of manager maturity when a manager can reach out and say, I need your help to do this. I'm counting on you. I can't do it without you. At a time when a person may be feeling a loss of importance and self-confidence, such a message acts as an antidote to those feelings and says that that person is very important and that the manager identifies the positive values of the change with their contribution as a member of the unit. Another technique for helping people overcome resistance to change is to remind people of the favors that have been done for them. In a sense, there is between us a psychological credit bank. Even in our common use of the language, we often say, after having done a favor for another, that's one you owe me. Sometimes when a favor has been done for us, we say to the other, I'll pay you back someday. This is a time for leaders to remind those others in the equation, hey, I went to bat for you a number of times. Now I'm calling in the chips. You owe me this one. And in exchange, the leader is relying on goodwill that has been previously established. Some members of management, usually those that are new and a little green, are bothered by the idea that they should do favors for their people. Managers who've been around a while and really understand the way in which people work are continually looking for favors that they can do for people. Not for a chosen few, but for each and every member of the unit, so that when the time for difficult change is at hand, there is a positive balance in the psychological bank account that exists between the leader and the group. Certainly the fierce loyalty that children will show for their parents comes from many years of nurturing and teaching and helping and giving. And in good families, the common pattern is for children to step forward rapidly with offers of help and assistance during their parents' declining years. It is a paying back time of life. This relationship can be used positively during a period of change. A number of other elements in the communication and feedback pattern between those instituting change and those that have to deal with change can help in this process. And one of those is to have an open discussion. This means that members of management should provide a very clear communication opportunity in which both the pros and the cons of change are fully discussed. There are always prices to be paid for change. And when employees understand that management sees some of the negatives which always accompany change, they can more clearly understand that while management is aware of the traps, is sensitive to the costs of change, it is still able to decide that because of the advantages, the pros outweigh the cons. Also, person-to-person discussion and involvement means that there is some predictability because I am in the know. I have some better understanding of what the change really entails and exactly how it will impact upon me. When you approach me in such a direct fashion, it signals to me that our relationship is remaining authentic, that in this change, nothing has changed between you and me. And to have an open discussion in which I can sense that any question I ask is considered fair game, that it is all right, that it is permissible for me to question and to challenge, then I have a sense that you are treating me as an adult rather than a child. I can feel that I am being treated as an adult, and this builds my sense of self-esteem. It reinforces an important image of myself and makes me feel more confident, at least in terms of our interpersonal relating. During periods of change, the rumor mill will run rampant. Usually the employee rumor mill is faster and more accurate than the management rumor mill. And so it behooves management to announce whatever changes are anticipated as promptly as possible. One manager who has my admiration and respect is one who typically leaves management meetings with his boss and immediately performs what he calls his walking tour, in which he walks through his unit, giving first one employee and then the other a brief synopsis of the change that has just been discussed and decided in the conference room down the hall, and promising that each will later receive a written summary or that there will be further discussion of the issue at their departmental staff meeting. What this has created in this relationship is a justified belief among employees that good information on a timely basis will be received from their boss. In this process, he also identifies what the limits of the change will be, who is going to be affected, what exactly is going to be covered, when it will occur, where it's going to happen, why it's going on, and when it will stop. By identifying each of these impact areas, he limits or puts fences around the change so that people understand that it isn't going to include a whole range of other possibilities. Recently, a hospital president had the unhappy experience of having to lay off 50 of his employees. He personally walked from unit to unit and held meetings in the employee cafeteria explaining why the change had occurred and offering assurances that there would be no further layoffs. While it was unsettling for employees to realize that bad economic times for this particular organization had caused a painful readjustment, they knew nonetheless that there need not be any further concern about it. By acting promptly, this executive contained the situation. Because the rumor mill operates with viciousness on occasion, because change itself tends to be confusing, it is important to recognize that information in the grapevine and the normal confusion caused by change can both lead to a feeling of hostility and negative emotional reaction. Therefore, don't equivocate about the change. Avoid the razzle-dazzle and the fancy footwork. Whatever change is going on is your change. It is your responsibility. No matter what the area of responsibility you have at work or in your role as a member of a family, whatever change you're instigating is your change. Therefore, it's important that you identify yourself as being part of the change. Don't step aside from it and mumble something about company policy or your father says. Welcome questions. Allow people to express what it is that is on their minds. Establish a dialogue with them to defuse the emotional hostility and the anger that may be present. Another major factor in managing change positively is time. Time. Allow it to work in your favor. If the implementation of the change can be put off to some time in the future, it is always easier for us to deal with than if we have to adapt to the change immediately. Time gives us an opportunity to become adjusted to this new, unfamiliar task or procedure or policy or set of relationships. Time allows for assimilation, and in assimilating myself into this new situation, I am removing emotion. One of the things that was understood very clearly in the return of the prisoners of war from Vietnam was the need to provide assimilation centers where they could be brought up to date with the major changes which had occurred within the United States from the time the soldiers left to the time they returned. During that turbulent decade, there had been major political realignments, major social changes, changes in mores, changes in technology, changes in street talk. What the armed forces did in these assimilation centers was to describe these changes and then encourage group discussion in which former POWs would, among themselves, debate and talk about these changes. It allowed them to make connection points with others to check their perceptions, their negative or positive reactions. It was found that even in the space of a few weeks in these centers, the culture shock was minimized as prisoners of war came back into society. Within your own social settings or within your employment setting, anything that you can do that will allow time to heal, that will allow time for growth, that will allow time for thinking it through, will be a very helpful component of change management. One of the major tools in change management is participation. If change is simply sprung on the employees, has leapt full-blown from the brow of Prometheus, if the junior god in the executive suite has simply sat down and dictated what the change will be, and no one else has been allowed to participate in that change, then that's asking for trouble. Effective management is seen when leaders go to employees and say, "We seem to be having some problems. I'd like to get your input." Or, "Let's chew this over in our departmental meetings. Give me your ideas as to what you think can be done." When we then allow the employees to contribute those change ideas, when we allow them to make suggestions that may mold and affect the final shaping of the idea, then we're allowing them to become committed through their ownership of change. Have you ever had a bad idea? When you've suggested something to your boss, did you ever suggest a bad idea? I don't know about you, but all the ideas I have are just wonderful. And if you'll allow me to put some of my ideas and some of my thinking into the change that you're proposing, why then I somehow have a stake in it. Psychologists refer to this approach as letting people become stakeholders. If we allow people to have a sense of ownership, a piece of the action, then they may be willing to go along with some of the ideas in which they did not have a stake. One of the things that comes out of this process is that they feel safer in knowing what is going on than they feel when they don't know what's going on. Now, granted, participation takes more time on the front end. But there's going to be a great savings in time on the back end when we get around to actually implementing the change. You don't always have the luxury or the opportunity of allowing for a participative let's sit down and think it out, and we've got 6 months to make these adjustments. But when you do have the luxury of time, when it is not inappropriate and you use it effectively, then on those occasions where management or where a parent must simply announce this must change and it must change now, there is going to be a greater willingness to go with the flow of that moment. People will see it as fair. They will rate this situation as being understandable if there is at least some opportunity to participate on other occasions. Another technique that can be used in managing change is to try and express the change in terms of the employee's own goals and objectives. What are their values? What is it that they need from the situation? What are the threats that concern them? If the change can be discussed in terms of what is important to them and their goals, you're likely to see greater change acceptance. This means that there has to be a lot of one-on-one discussion in which the manager takes the time to really understand each party's feelings and to visit with them about the change and their perspective of that change. A parent understands that Ellen may not see things the same way her brother Roy sees them, so you have to listen to each child from the perspective on the family that they bring to it. Some people will write this off as hand-holding, when in reality it's an investment that the leader is making in this person, which allows that individual on their own to come to a sense of commitment for the change. The great sociologist Harry Stack Sullivan referred to those people who have a major impact on our lives as significant others. These other people were significant, Sullivan said. What they felt on an issue, what they thought, how they acted, influenced our own attitudes and actions. In change management, one way to control change is to seek for the significant others in this person's life. For example, if we can say to a particular employee that a majority of the employees in the unit have decided they would like to go with the change, an employee, while he or she may not like the change, may still be willing to agree to the wishes of the majority because of their significance in their own work life. Sometimes you can appeal to their responsiveness to expert testimony. I understand your feeling, but Dr. Grinelda Fladhammer has said that this is the way it needs to be done for our own betterment. Since Dr. Fladhammer may be a respected individual, John may be willing more readily to accept the change. If employees can understand that their competitors down the street are installing the new technology and putting robots on the assembly line, and that the Japanese, having done this already, have gained a competitive advantage in the marketplace which now threatens our own economic survival, then employees may be more willing to adopt the change. In a sense, our own idealized image of ourself, our superego, the best picture that all of us have of ourselves in our finest moments, can also be appealed to as a significant other. Sometimes we can appeal to people to do it just because it's the right thing to do. Mary, I know this is a difficult task, but I'm asking you to buy in. I know that you're enough of a professional to understand that we must do this because it is the right thing for us to do. And Mary will often respond to that image out of her own sense of personal excellence. If the appeal is genuinely meant and is not manipulative, Mary may be willing to accede to change.